Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
Now, time for a look at global news, and glad to be joined as usual on Monday by Thomas Conway. Good morning to you, Thomas.
And good morning, Fran.
Let me turn on those headphones for you. I think they should be working.
Thank you very much.
Now, good to see you as always. Before we go global, thoughts on Leo stepping down and Simon Harris taking over, a presumptive Taoiseach at this point?
It was a major shock. I think like everyone last Wednesday, I was flabbergasted when the news finally emerged that that Leo was to step aside. He says personal and political reasons. We have to trust him on that. And obviously, you would wish him the best. I think he has a bright future ahead of him, Leo Varadkar. He's only 45. There are so many jobs out there, both in the private and the public sector. Speculation maybe that he would consider a European job. I'm not sure this time round that it will be the time for that. But certainly in the future, you could see him heading up one of the EU institutions.
He won't be short of a few bob, you think, anyway.
No, certainly not. But Simon Harris, I wish him the best. He's great sense of vitality about him.
Yeah.
We were talking off air. He's probably going to bring Fine Gael back to its traditional core values, which probably needed to be done. And electorally, they will hope to benefit from that. So it'll be very interesting.
And again, we were saying off air, there is that void there now for centre-right in some way.
Yeah, there is a space there which Fine Gael, I think, can move into. They've moved somewhat towards the centre in recent years, and it hasn't maybe played well with their core grassroots voters. Harris now has an opportunity to take them back towards the centre-right, to the kind of more traditional Fine Gael values, and that, judging by his speech yesterday, is what he's seeking to achieve.
It'll be very interesting indeed. All right, let's go global, and let's go to that unfortunate situation that's still going on in Gaza. But Blinken, once again, is that his sixth time?
It's his sixth tour of the Middle East. He's really another whistle-stop tour, and he makes it around the place. He goes from Egypt to Lebanon, to Israel. He really puts in the air miles and puts in the effort. The thing is, I think it's yielding very little in terms of the preferred outcome of the Americans and the West in general. Israel seems determined to continue to execute this war against Hamas, and it seems like there's very little going to stop it. Now, it should be said, Hamas, I was looking at the figures for this yesterday, just comparing them. Hamas has been badly damaged. Around 13,000 soldiers, they estimate, have been killed. That's around half of Hamas's pre-war strength. So, you know, it has taken a hit here, but it remains on the ground in Gaza. There remains a significant cohort of the population there who are affiliated with Hamas and who are acting on behalf of Hamas. So it's going to be very hard to exterminate them completely. That's what Netanyahu seems intent on doing. He wants total annihilation of Hamas forces on the ground in Gaza.
There's still talk about that ground invasion of Rafah, for example. And I heard a description on national radio this morning of the population there and how dense it is and the devastation that would be caused by any kind of ground invasion there on top of what these people are suffering already.
Yeah, it is appalling. And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres outlined it at the weekend when he described it as, I think, a nightmare scenario, a nightmare of nightmares for the people of Gaza. If that Rafah invasion were to go ahead, I think that would amount to a serious escalation on the part of Israel. And I would be very interested to see the American response to this, because for the first time, senior American politicians are openly starting to question the issue of giving military aid to Israel. In the past, that was taboo subject. They wouldn't go near it. Israel were firm allies. The US would always support them through thick and thin. Last week, you had a landmark speech by a senior Democratic senator. His name was Chuck Schumer. He's the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, and he's the highest ranking Jewish official, I think, in US history. Certainly at the present moment, he's the highest ranking. He came out and he rebuked Netanyahu, basically called for an early election, said Netanyahu has to get out of here. This fighting has to stop. This war, this persecution has to stop. So that was as strong a statement as any from a very senior US politician.
And we're seeing man-made famine there at the moment, which is just, you know, unspeakable when you think about it. Blinken, he will be in Saudi Arabia, is that it?
Yeah.
And who is he meeting with?
Well, he was speculated to have met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman last week, who is a very powerful individual. As I've said before in this program, as we've discussed, you think the Middle East, you think two countries, Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the kind of proxy war, the division that exists between those two countries. Mohammed bin Salman, the leader of Saudi Arabia, he's the crown prince, but he's de facto the ruler of Saudi Arabia, is a key figure on that. And in recent years, Saudi Arabia has moved closer to Israel. So there were a thing called the Abraham Accords struck back under President Trump, in fact, in 2020, in which a couple of Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, recognised Israel, basically, and started establishing trade and economic ties with them. Mm. Now, that has been jeopardised by Israel's war against Hamas and the war against the Palestinian population. So clearly, Anthony Blinken will be looking to convince Mohammed bin Salman that, you know, there is still a relationship that should exist between the Saudi Arabians and the Israelis, that they do have a role to play. And I think these Arab states will be increasingly influential in terms of the future of Gaza. And where is the future of Gaza? It is very hard to predict because, you know, you take a situation, if Hamas is wiped out in Gaza, which is unlikely, in my opinion, do you then get the Palestinian Authority, which is the authority which is in control of the West Bank, to preside over Gaza? There is very little faith in their leader, Mahmoud Abbas. He's not a popular man. He's an aging representative at this stage now. And there is very little likelihood that he'll be able to put together or construct a government capable of taking charge of Gaza. So it's all up in the air, really. It's very hard to see.
Of course, it's in the interest of Saudi as well to cozy up with the Americans.
There's a very, very strong relationship which exists between Saudi and the United States. And we have seen that right through the Trump administration. Even as far as Joe Biden is concerned, they are wedded together. And in the fight against Iran in the region, that is where the US is really valuable to Saudi Arabia in terms of providing weaponry and providing aid to battle against Iran's access of resistance. And that access of resistance is increasingly sprawling across the Middle East. We've seen Iran try to kind of ignite proxy wars in various parts of the region. They will continue to do so. They will continue to stir unrest. And I think it is up to the Americans and the Saudis to stop it.
And Thomas, it's a little early to speculate, I suppose, but eventually there will be a rebuilding of Gaza. And we have to keep that in mind as well in terms of what will happen there.
Yeah, and you have to think of the Gaza population and what they will think. You know, I mean, this is a population which has been almost exterminated in the past few months, and the antipathy or the resentment that must exist towards Israel is probably beyond what we could imagine.
So will something emerge that will replace Hamas then? Is that the danger because of this hatred that you're
And that is the thing. It will lure, it will be a hotbed of extremism, you would think, because of the resentment that exists there. I mentioned the Palestinian Authority. Are they to come in? Are they to be the ones to take control of Gaza and govern the region? Or is it maybe a coalition of Arab states, the likes of Saudi Arabia, the likes of Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, who come in and try to construct some sort of unity government, some sort of stable government to take control of Gaza? And then the question of the two-state solution. How far are we from, you know, a situation whereby an independent Palestine exists alongside that of Israel? It seems that's a far-off prospect at present. It seems inconceivable, really, to think that could occur. But it's a desperate situation, really. And it looks set to continue because there looks to be no end in sight for this foreseeable future. As long as Benjamin Netanyahu is in power, certainly Israel are going to go all out for the kill.
Let us move to Russia, and Putin again anointed as leader for another 6 years. I guess no surprise to anybody there, Thomas.
No surprise, but I mean, he's had domestic issues most recently. This awful atrocity on Friday, which occurred, 137 people killed in a concert massacre. on behalf of Islamic State. So Islamic State have claimed responsibility for the killing. Immediately, Putin was out and tried to shift the blame towards Ukraine.
Yeah.
So he suggested that the fighters were making their way back towards Ukraine. It's something Volodymyr Zelensky has completely dismissed outright. I'd be in agreement with Zelensky. I don't think it had anything to do with Ukraine. There were reports that US intelligence had warned Russia of a potential attack.
I found that very interesting.
I found it interesting too, and that Putin had effectively ignored it, which is very serious and could have very serious ramifications for Vladimir Putin domestically in terms of his own popularity. But I mean, when you look at that presidential vote last week, 87% of the vote, practically unchallenged. I know it was a staged election and it was a one-man show always, but 87% is an overwhelming majority to get in support of you. And it just shows that Russia sees no alternative at present. I mean, Alexei Navalny is dead. Hope, it seems, is dead. Hope in a future opposition, in a credible democratic threat to Vladimir Putin, is dead. He's 71 years of age, which means he's going to be around for a while, barring an unforeseen health issue.
And I guess with the way things are, there's no overseeing of that democratic process in Russia, is there? There's no...
No, I mean, Putin has total control of that. And we've seen that throughout the years, the way he's managed to manipulate the system, the way he skillfully kind of moved from president to prime minister at one stage, but retained all the power. He then reconstructed the constitution to ensure that he could stay in power for another several years. And that is where he is at present. He's, you know, inside in the Kremlin, the man pulling the strings. And there seems to be no credible opposition to him. We see small protests breaking out, you know, with Navalny's death and the funeral and all that brought about. They were very small in even in respect of what might have happened in the past. You know, far greater outbursts in the past. And it is a dire situation.
He's 71 years old, Thomas. It's interesting, though, that all of that propaganda that said he was very unwell and that mentally he was unstable and, you know, a possibility of Parkinson's and all of that. And then we had that interview with Tucker Carlson, like, where he seemed to be very, very healthy and very sharp. Yeah. And with it, he might be 71, but he's there for the long haul.
Oh, yeah. I think he's in the best of his health. I think he is in there for the long haul. And you could see him surviving, I mean, as ruler for another 10 plus years, for another decade or more. And where does that leave Russia? Because does it continue to persecute its war in Ukraine? Does it continue to endure the sanctions? It has built up a war economy. So it has managed to survive against all the odds. And Russia will have to, you know, I'll just remind people, is now a moderately sized economy. It's no longer the big powerhouse of Soviet times. In economic terms, it is not a global superpower. But in military terms, it punches well above its weight because its stock of nuclear warheads and nuclear weapons.
Where is that relationship with China now?
It's kind of in a very funny place because Xi Jinping, we haven't heard a lot from Xi Jinping. I'll feature him in the programme one week because there are domestic things happening in China, I think, that have occupied him and kept his concerns. But certainly there is a relationship that exists here between Russia and China. But China has been cautious and has been careful not to get in too deep into this war in Ukraine. Russia has other allies, Iran, North Korea, China. They're all kind of this alliance, this anti-Western alliance, which has formed in recent years. And it has morphed into a very dangerous threat to the West. And it poses serious ramifications for the West. I mean, it will be very interesting to see how China manages this war as we go forward. Because if Russia is left to endure these sanctions, it will have to be increasingly dependent on China for many of its economic goods and its substitute goods.
Is it fair to say that sanctions just hasn't worked?
Sanctions haven't really worked. Right. And that is the long and the short of it. I mean, you've had, I think, 13 rounds of sanctions on behalf of the EU. The US have imposed something similar. Maybe at the start they had, I suppose we have sort of weaned ourselves off Russian oil and Russian gas, but there is still a large dependence there. And the degree of dependence on Russia in the first place was unacceptable. What was allowed to occur prior to this invasion, our dependence on Russia for oil and gas imports was absolutely incredible. And now we have a situation whereby we're trying to wean ourselves off that, but the sanctions aren't really proving effective. So Russia is still in a relatively strong position in economic terms, as well as the fact that it's winning on the battlefield.
Right. But is it fair, and just briefly, because I do want to move on to our historic figure, but is it fair to say the only way the change will happen is if the people of Russia rise up?
I think that's the only way. I think it's going to have to be an internal revolt. And, you know, you could argue we've had opportunities for that in the past year. We've had Yevgeny Prigozhin and the Wagner mercenaries and their march on Moscow. Prigozhin, now dead. We have Alexei Navalny. He's now dead. Yulia Navalnaya, obviously Navalny's wife, is, I suppose, the next person who comes to mind when you think of an opposition. But she is outside the country, and it's limited what she can achieve from there. So it looks very grim. The prospects for Russia's democratic future look very grim. The question is, how long will Russian citizens put up with it? And how long can its economy continue to endure these sanctions and these punitive measures? It seems they've built a strong economy now. It seems they're in this for the long haul, and they have a plan. So we'll just have to wait and see.
We'll have to wait and see. Our historic figure this week, Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And immediately when we think of him, I think most people, the only thing we know about him is that he's killing sparked World War One. But there's much more to this guy.
There is. He had a fascinating backstory. Yeah. He was the heir presumptive to the Austro-Hungarian throne. So he was the leader to be of Austro-Hungary. That was because a number of the other successors, I think one committed suicide, another died, and he was left directly in line to the throne. He was a powerful man. He was in charge of the Austro-Hungarian military, in effect. And that was part of his reasoning for being in Sarajevo on that fateful date. I think it was the 18th of July, was it, 1914?
Yeah.
Whatever it was. And the reason that he was murdered by a student, a young Bosnian Serb student named Gavrilo Princep, who assassinated both him and his wife, the Duchess of Hohenberg. And immediately that triggered a diplomatic crisis across Europe. It sent embassies into overdrive. There was something called the July Crisis, which was a series, I think, of diplomatic and political crises in various countries that eventually led to alliances being declared, and eventually it would lead to the breakout of the war.
Is it fair, and I'm going a little bit off top, is it fair to say that all of this was simmering, though? You know.
Yeah, it was a very hostile environment because, you know, Austria-Hungary and Serbia, obviously intense rivals, and anyone who even has a passing knowledge of the history of the First World War will tell you that. And the alliances there that were quickly struck, Germany on the side of the Central Powers, France, Britain, America on the side of the Allies, quickly those alliances formed, and quickly a very bloody and brutal campaign got underway. And you know, what transpired was the Great War, as it was called, as it was initially known, trench warfare, the start of this real aggressive form of trench warfare, and it had devastating consequences. And the thing I think, when I think about the First World War, is the second was a direct corollary to it. It directly led, the Treaty of Versailles post in the aftermath of World War One was one of the reasons, effectively, for Hitler's rise in Nazi Germany and for Mussolini's rise in Italy. So it directly precipitated the chain of events that led to the Second World War.
And to get back to Franz Ferdinand himself then, Thomas, I mean, you mentioned that his wife was killed alongside him, but there's an interesting story. His marriage, in fact, I learned a new word this morning that you came up with. It's morganatic?
Morgantic or morganatic, yes. Yeah.
So he married beneath him, essentially.
Yeah, essentially. And nobody approved of it. Nobody in the royal household, once they got wind of this, they were furious. And he had to, I think, renounce some of his rights.
That his descendants could not take the throne because of his choice of
precisely, wife. Precisely. Yeah. Because he married below them. Now, it was a tale of forbidden love, a classic tale of forbidden love. And it was very interesting. And, of course, she was wedded to him. She was alongside him when he was shot, and she was shot and killed as well on that morning on the 14th of April. So a really, he had a really interesting backstory. He travelled the world again as well. He circumnavigated the globe, I think, in 1912 or thereabouts. So he was a really interesting character, and a man who clearly had knowledge of the world, clearly had intellect, and had he survived The course of the 20th century might have been very different, but the fact of the matter was he didn't, and he was murdered by this Yugoslav, this student who was seeking to establish an independent Yugoslavian state in Austro-Hungary.
It's very, very interesting. Sadly, we don't have time to go into it in any more detail, but would it be fair to say that that assassination was chaotic? It was a mess.
It was a mess from start to finish, because there was actually an attempt on it before the shots were fired. There was an attempt on their carriage, I think, to bomb the carriage with a grenade or something like that. That caused all sorts of consternation. And then later in the morning or later in the afternoon, the two were assassinated by the hand of that student assassin, Gavrilo Princip. But yeah, it was chaotic, a chaotic chain of events in Sarajevo, I should mention. That was the city in which it took place.
Yes.
And you can actually see, my dad explained it to me this morning, he saw the carriage in which Franz Ferdinand and his wife were travelling. It's on display in Vienna. So anyone is in Vienna anytime soon, go and have a look for it. It is an incredibly important piece of historical significance,
of those,
you know.
Very, very interesting. And there's much more to the story, but well worth a read if that's your thing. Just before I let you go, we have only about 30 seconds left. What should we look out for? What's the...
So I spotted during the week this EU-Canada trade deal, CETA, highly controversial amongst the Irish farming community as well as Europe, but French senators have opted to reject it, and that is largely because of agricultural concerns that I suppose it would undercut prices and have all sorts of ramifications in terms of French agriculture and European agriculture. It leaves the EU in a sticky position because, you know, the EU likes to put out these trade deals as major new initiatives, and it likes to, you know, showcase them to the world and show them as a sign of progress. So a little bit of unrest in France, which Emmanuel Macron will be trying to quell. As well as that, questions around the turnout for the upcoming European parliamentary elections, which is huge. And now not every country, it must be remembered, has local elections at the same time. So the turnout in Ireland is generally relatively stable. That, I think, is in large part because we have our local elections at the same time. That's not the same case everywhere. So in certain countries, they will just have European elections.
I think, to be honest with you, that the European elections will seem more relevant to us than ever before at this particular time. Would you?
Yeah, I would concur with that. Yeah. I think it's an incredibly important moment for Europe. I think there is genuine interest in Europe now. I think whether it's a legacy of Brexit and all of that, of the COVID pandemic and the role that Europe played there, or maybe just even key figures like Ursula von der Leyen and that, people are really coming to accept the significance of the EU, and they're looking at our foreign policy stance in respect maybe of the war in Gaza or the war in Ukraine, and they're thinking in a European frame of mind towards that.
Be very interesting.
I agree with you completely there, Fran. Oh, yeah.
Thomas, great to see you as always.
Thanks
very
Fran.
Much, Thomas Conway. We'll take a break. News is on the way.
Tip today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. You can't beat experience. With over 50 years maintaining Peugeot cars and vans, we like to call ourselves the experts. Call Slattery's Garage for a free vehicle health check today. 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.